This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Tears, defiance, and raw partisan rancor on full display yesterday on Capitol Hill. An aspiring Supreme Court justice, his nomination hanging in the balance, testified under oath. So did his accuser, a Stanford research psychologist.
I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
This is a circus. The consequences will extend long past my nomination. The consequences will be with us for decades.
Trump and the world. At the United Nations, the president pushed his America First foreign policy.
America is governed by Americans. We reject the ideology of globalism, and we embrace the doctrine of patriotism.
This hour on Point, the news roundtable dives into deep waters. You can join us on air or online. What did yesterday's hearing reveal to you about Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh? What did it reveal about lawmakers, about our democracy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and on Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Washington is James Homan, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. He's also author of the Daily 202 newsletter. You can discover today's edition at our website, onpointradio.org. James Homan, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, David.
And with us from Austin, Texas is Kimberly Atkins. She's, of course, the chief Washington reporter and columnist at the Boston Herald. You can find her latest piece headline, Trump Finally Got His Candidate, at our website, onpointradio.org. Kimberly Atkins, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Kim, and James.
Well, here's what we know. We now know that Brett Kavanaugh appears to have done what he needed to do. He has votes from the Republican side of the Senate Judiciary Committee so that this will ultimately be headed to the full Senate. One of the key votes on the committee, of course, is Jeff Flake. And moments before the Judiciary Committee opened its session this morning, Jeff Flake, a Republican senator from Arizona, confirmed he would vote for Brett Kavanaugh to be elevated to the nation's highest court. He was then confronted by protesters who essentially trapped him in an elevator.
Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter, that what happened to me doesn't matter, and that you're going to let people who do these things into power. That's what you're telling me when you vote for him. Don't look away from me. Look at me and tell me that it doesn't matter what happened to me. That you'll let people like that go into the highest court of the land and tell everyone what they can do to their bodies.
Emotions high, stakes high. James Homan, what does this presage for what the fate will be for Brett Kavanaugh's nomination in the full Senate?
Well, David, it looks like they're pushing ahead. They told senators they have to stick around this weekend. Originally, everyone planned to go home. But the way that it works, you have to have 40 hours of floor time pass to be able to have a vote for the full Senate. So senators going to be casting a vote on Saturday and then a full vote on Monday. And there are still some undecided senators, the two moderate women Republicans, Susan Collins from Maine and Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, keeping their cards close to their vest in light of this hearing. Murkowski getting a lot of pressure, not just because of the sexual assault allegations, but also because Kavanaugh has made some decisions that are very adverse to Alaska natives, and they were key to her reelection. So she feels a special affinity to them. Republicans can afford to lose one vote. They have a 51-seat majority. Mike Pence can cast the tie-breaking vote. And so Republicans might end up letting Murkowski go if they can get Collins. And then if it looks like Kavanaugh is going to get through, there are one or two Democrats, Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Joe Donnelly from Indiana, who may get on board with Kavanaugh because they're both up for reelection in states that President Trump carried by double digits, and they want to avoid the attack ads. But they're under a lot of pressure from their progressive bases saying, we're going to stay home. We're not going to give you money if you vote for this guy who otherwise the Democratic Party is unified in opposition to.
Kim Atkins, let's take a moment and think back on the remarkable scene that we saw yesterday. As a reporter, as a lawyer, which you also are, what do you make of what we saw play out? How illuminating were the hearings yesterday?
Yeah, they were quite illuminating. It really switched politically. We saw a complete switch from the morning to the afternoon in the political atmosphere after Dr. Ford came forward and gave her gripping testimony. I don't know how else you could describe it. She was poised. She called on not only her own memories and the trauma that she said she suffered, but also on her psychological expertise to explain exactly why she was so confident in her memory of what happened in describing this attack that she said was perpetrated by Brett Kavanaugh when they were in high school. But then by the afternoon, by the morning, there were Republicans were really worried after her testimony.
And let's just pause right there. I want to hear a little bit of what she said. Remind listeners of how compelling that was. In her opening statement yesterday, Christine Blasey Ford said that back at a party when she was 15 and he was 17, Brett Kavanaugh, quote, she said, groped me and tried to take off my clothes. And then she said she feared for her life.
I believed he was going to rape me. I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life. It was hard for me to breathe, and I thought that Brett was accidentally going to kill me.
And I thought it was interesting also, she was asked then by Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont what she remembered most about the alleged assault. And from Kavanaugh and also his friend Mark Judge, which both men deny, here's what that exchange sounded like.
What is the strongest memory you have? Strongest memory of the incident? Something that you cannot forget?
Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter, the uproarious laughter between the two, and they're having fun at my expense.
Kimberly Atkins, for drawing upon her human experience and also her expertise as a researcher, how credible, how plausible did she come across as a witness?
I think she came across very, very credible, and she was, it was gripping. I don't think anybody who saw that testimony, regardless of where they stand on the political spectrum, were not moved by that. And again, that is why Republicans were worried at that midpoint of the hearings until Brett Kavanaugh came out and really became very different from the Brett Kavanaugh we saw give an interview on Fox News earlier this week. He came out combative. He was combative. He was angry. And he was partisan in a way that judges aren't often perceived. Usually, judicial nominees, particularly those for the U.S. Supreme Court, go out of their way to characterize themselves as objective umpires who are not going to let their views affect their ruling. Brett Kavanaugh came out as and attacked Democrats specifically for doing an orchestra, accused them of engaging in an orchestrated hit job on his nomination. And that was really extraordinary.
Chuck Beatty, I want to play for you a clip of how Kavanaugh defended himself yesterday. In this, he's claiming essentially that Democrats in the Senate had developed a, quote, long series of false last-minute smears to block his nomination.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
Jack Beatty, Judge Kavanaugh spoke in rending terms about the emotional toll all this has taken on him and his family. But what is the implications of him talking in such partisan terms about the Supreme Court process?
Well, Nina Totenberg says that it will, if he does go on the court, it will cast a shadow on all sorts of decisions he would make, because liberal interest groups – bring you know, are involved in suits before the Supreme Court. And every time that happens, people will say, well, he's just acting out his resentment. Of course, similar things has been said about Clarence Thomas over the years.
Well, Jack, do you feel as though this is substantively different than what we've seen? You've seen partisan appointments before, or at least partisan clashes over these appointments before. Is this really a break, or is this in keeping with past appointments?
Well, I mean, nothing is today. I mean, we're in a new period of political tribalism. I think the significance of yesterday is in the reaction to it. I think it's part of what is a kind of rolling, seismic event. Alex Castellanos, the GOP strategist, calls it a pink wave. And that pink wave is shaping up to sweep the Republicans at least out of the House in November. Over 500 women ran in the primaries. 255 are on the ballot now. They're mostly women. You look at the gender gaps in the Florida, the Democratic candidates ahead by 17 among women, in Arizona by 15 among women, in Michigan by 24 among women, in Wisconsin 27 among women. What happened yesterday is only going to increase that, and it'll help us, and it'll sort of give point to the hypothesis of a historian on our show right after the Women's March following Trump's inauguration. Beverly Gage said the significance of the Trump era will be the reaction to Trump. We may see that acting out, being acted out.
We're going to be talking a little bit about the political implications, about what's happening in the Senate ahead, and also about what this does to the country and its understanding of both the Supreme Court and about the question of how accusations of sexual assault, sexual harassment are treated in the country. We want you to stick by. We are going to be starting to take your calls as soon as we come back. Kimberly Atkins, James Holman, Jack Beatty, stick around. You stick around, too. We're talking about this monumental week in the news. Is this just an unfair attack by Democrats on the character of Judge Kavanaugh, or a powerful moment in the Me Too era? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking at the week in the news, and we'll keep talking about this week's biggest story on this segment. You can join the conversation. Do these allegations about Judge Kavanaugh require fuller investigation by the FBI? How fairly is Kavanaugh being treated? Do you feel your senators have enough information to vote on his nomination? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Herald, James Holman of the Washington Post, and of course, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, I do want to take a couple of your calls from Bath, Maine. Susan is on the line. Susan, what did you take from what you saw?
Hi, David.
Hiya.
So I think the tears that we saw from Judge Kavanaugh yesterday were tears of remorse without acknowledgement. I think he knows that this happened. And I think that nothing that he said contradicts what Dr. Ford said. He knew every person that she said was at that party. She never said it was a weekend party. It could be weekend or weekday. She identified an 8-mile stretch between her home and the quote-unquote country club where this could have taken place. Mr. Kavanaugh's high school yearbook summation, his character summation, his activity summation is damning. He was the treasurer of the, 100 keg club.
So, Susan, you took sort of
that.
Susan, you took the broad sweep of what he had to say and the details, and from that you didn't find him completely credible. Is that right?
No, I didn't. I think this was like a boy saying in front of the Old Boy Network, "Dad, please, please don't take my license away or the car away. Please take, see what a good boy I have been since this happened."
All right, Susan, well, thank you for that. That's Susan from Bath, Maine. I want to play a little bit for listeners and for our analysts here. Brett Kavanaugh had to say, Judge Kavanaugh had to say, when he was being asked by Rachel Mitchell, a Arizona prosecutor hired by Senate Republicans to lead their questioning, she asked Kavanaugh about Ford's testimony, that she'd been alone in a room with Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge. Here's the exchange, and I do want to warn you, some of the description is graphic.
Dr. Ford described an incident where she was alone in a room with you and Mark Judge. Have you ever been alone in a room with Dr. Ford and Mark Judge?
No.
Dr. Ford described an incident where you were grinding your genitals on her. Have you ever ground or rubbed your genitals against Dr. Ford?
No.
We've got a call from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Harrison, what did you hear?
Well, whenever I heard that, I heard an innocent man. Like, because I watched the whole thing yesterday, but My comment is that what I kind of feel like is happening is that whenever you have a woman make an accusation on a man, he's automatically, like, seen guilty. And that's what's happening now. And that's why he was so angry yesterday, is because his whole reputation is, like, it's ruined because this person came out and made this accusation towards him, which I saw her speak. I kind of believe her, too. I actually do believe her. I think she has the wrong person. It's a possibility that she could have mistaken identity. And when you don't have absolutely any witnesses, I just don't see how people can start, like, placing blame on him with no
witnesses. Harrison, let me briefly ask you, did you support or oppose him going into yesterday's hearings?
Now, and I have to admit on that, I am biased because I'm conservative. So I did.
It's not biased, but I'm interested in sort of how it shapes what people have to say. Harrison, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate this very much. James Holman, let me ask you about this. Let's talk about the decision by the Senate Judiciary Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa to hire Mitchell, this sex crimes prosecutor, to ask the questions for the all-male Republican side.
Yeah, David, it was a tough, controversial decision, just like in 1991 when Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill both testified. Every Republican on the committee is all male. They were afraid of the optics of having 11 Republican men, many of them in their 70s and 80s, questioning Dr. Ford. The feeling on the Republican side is that it did not go well. The morning when they let her question Dr. Ford, it sort of in some ways was sympathetic to her case. And then initially when they were questioning Judge Kavanaugh, it felt very legalistic and it was very much focused on the facts of the underlying case. And that is when Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, called an audible, decided he was not going to turn over his 5 minutes of time for the prosecutor to question Judge Kavanaugh, but instead use that time to vigorously attack Democrats.
And let's just take a moment and listen to what he said, because he brought the fire. Here's South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham exploding during the Kavanaugh testimony yesterday afternoon.
What you want to do is destroy this guy's life, hold this seat open, and hope you win in 2020. You've said that, not me. You've got nothing to apologize for. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said hello, because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy. This is the most unethical sham since I've been in politics.
Kimberly Atkins, Senate Democrats, several members of the committee walked out earlier this morning of the hearing on the Kavanaugh nomination. And Democrats, particularly Dianne Feinstein, have been criticized for their handling of Professor Ford's allegations and the way in which it sort of emerged and surfaced at the very end. How do these guys work together? How fair is Graham's anger and his characterization of what the Democrats have done?
Look, I think what we have here is, and I've said this before on this program, the Senate is vetting a claim of sexual assault. there is, I can't think of a less proper or less apt place for such a claim, to try to get to the truth of such a claim than the U.S. Senate, which has become one of the most politicized, partisan, just, you know, it's a bare knuckled political fight taking place around this allegation. And that's what we're seeing play out. There was really no way to get to the truth in this forum, but this is the only forum that is available at this point to get to the truth. And absent any objective investigation, and one thing that some folks have called for is an FBI investigation, I don't even think that would be sufficient. So we are seeing—
Wait a second. So you're saying that even though Democrats are saying we should have an FBI investigation, you don't think that would be sufficient. What would be sufficient in your mind? I mean, what do Americans need? What do their representatives need to kind of make this decision?
Generally speaking, these kinds of claims are made in places like a court of law, which also may not be perfect, but at least you have evidentiary rules. You have representation on both sides. You have all of more levers that are aimed at finding the truth, fact-finding, and finding and making a just result. These are members of Congress. They're not judges. They're not jurors. These are members of the Senate that are going to make this call. And at the end of the day, it's going to be based on politics just as much as it's going to be based on what they saw take place yesterday. And so this is just a very different place. So this is why we're seeing this open battle. This is why we're seeing the conventional wisdom of what will happen shift by the hour. Earlier, before the hearing, when Senator Graham was speaking in a very coarse partisan way, I was speaking to Republican strategists who really were worried that Lindsey Graham was going to ruin it for them. And by the end, they were cheering him by the end of the day, because he came in, as James said, and that was when the members, the all-male panel of the GOP on the Judiciary Committee finally spoke, broke their silence that they had engaged in all day, was to decry this, what they saw as this partisan attack, join with Judge Kavanaugh in making that claim. And every other Republican after Graham spoke, used their own time and did not cede it to the prosecutor, Rachel Mitchell, at that point on. It was a literal political sea change at that point.
I want to take a call now from Aaron. Aaron, you're calling, I believe, from Detroit, Michigan. What do you take from this?
Hi, David.
Hiya.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Listen, let me set up a visual first. When you breach the integrity of any structure, system, belief, or anything, it weakens the entire thing, and then there's a continuation of it. What we're seeing here, and not individualizing this particular incident, but what this is a result of a breakdown. Now, trace it back, follow it back through when President Obama was a seated president. The Republicans said, we are not going to allow you, even though you're a seated president and had the right to do so constitutionally, to elect or to nominate a justice. They refused to do that.
You're thinking about Merrick Garland there.
Yeah, go back from there and remember how Republicans said about him when he was elected, that our only job is to stop anything that he does. And then you keep tracing things back and you see how the system was breached, and now the integrity of the whole structure has been breached, and now we are the laughing stock. When we once were touted after to be followed after, and everybody wanted to form a government and a system like ours,
sure.
Now
we are the So, Aaron, thank you for that. You're framing it as basically a systemic breakdown. Jack Beatty, talk to me about this. Is this a structural breakdown, or is this just a highly partisan moment?
Well, I mean, the Republicans have their own sort of indignation regress. They go back to Judge Bork. They said, look, here's the original sin. Mm-hmm. I just don't see how you can get around two sort of questions. To take out Occam's razor for a quick wield,
for a quick shave.
Yeah. Number one, he had everything. He has everything to gain by lying. Everything. She has nothing. Number two, she's in favor of a FBI investigation, which wouldn't be conclusory, but which could suggest all sorts of things, and having having the third person, the alleged third person in the room, Mark Judd, give a FBI interview could actually be, could open up genuine evidence. he's against it. Those two things, it seems to me, just weigh heavily into believing her. And yet, it looks as if the Republicans are poised to put him on the court. If they do, the taint of Trump, which really has tarnished the presidency, his lying, his vulgarity, tarnished the presidency, it will now tarnish the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. I want to play a clip from earlier today. White House advisor Kellyanne Conway, speaking on CBS this morning, said Christine Blasey Ford was definitely wronged by somebody, but insisted it wasn't Judge Kavanaugh.
I've said from the beginning, it may turn out that they're both right, that she was sexually assaulted, but that he had nothing to do with it. And I think America saw that yesterday. I don't know why also that we have to look at every woman automatically as a victim. If you're a woman, every man is a bad perpetrator.
I'd like to take a call now from Buffalo, New York. Rachel is calling, and she's saying these decisions by the Senate majority Republicans are going to have some real repercussions. Tell me what this stirs in you, Rachel.
Hi, David. Well, I believe that the Republican Senate majority has no idea about the backlash that they will face from people who are irate over this spectacle. I think that there are many people who were already upset with a lot of political goings-on, the tarnishing of the presidency that someone spoke of just a moment ago. And now people recognize that a woman has come forward with this deep, deeply felt truth and something that feels very, very true to many of us who have either experienced an assault or a near assault or have been in places and heard stories from other people who have had similar situations. It feels very real. It feels very brave. And those of us who are simply citizens are organizing and mobilizing to stand up against it. And I think that we'll see the results of that in November, and I think we'll continue to see it for a long time forward.
I'd like to take a call now. Thank you so much, Rachel. I'd like to take another call, this time from Boston, Massachusetts. Melissa, go ahead. Melissa,
are
you there? Hi.
Hi, David. I wanted to just make a comment that really hasn't been discussed, and none of us were in the room that night. But one of the things that has become very clear is that Kavanaugh participated in a culture of sexism that was very much alive at Georgetown Prep and other schools in the area at the time. I'm a contemporary of Kavanaugh and Christine Ford. I grew up in Washington, D.C. I went to a privileged private school. I drove by Georgetown Prep and Columbia Country Club every day growing up. And we know now from the yearbook that his senior year, that clearly he and other people participated in a behavior of conquest and bragging about it that was endorsed by the school, that was published in the yearbook. And whether he committed this particular act or not, we do know that he was participating in a culture of sexism at the time.
Melissa, I just want to ask you very briefly, when you hear Republicans, when you hear the president's aide saying, look, I believe something happened to her, I believe her story, but I believe him too, and it wasn't him. How does that strike you?
Scientifically, that just doesn't add up. There's no evidence of that, that trauma survivors who have very vivid memories have mistaken identity. There's no scientific evidence to demonstrate that that would be true.
Melissa, thank you so much for your call and for your personal perspective on that. James Homan, take a moment. You know, you've heard from a couple callers here who've talked about what this stirs in them, two female callers, and the idea of repercussions. How is this likely to shape in the minute we have left in this segment what we are to expect some weeks from now in the midterms?
I think there's going to be a historic gender gap. I think what's going to happen is Democrats are going to win the battle in November. Republicans are going to win the war. It looks at this hour like Kavanaugh is going to get on the Supreme Court. He's only 53 years old. He'll be there for 30, 40 years. He may be tainted, as Jack was saying earlier, but he's going to – a vote is a vote. It doesn't matter how tainted he is. Clarence Thomas has still been able to cast a vote. So I think there's going to be massive blowback in November from women. There's going to be a historic gender gap, but – Republicans will have succeeded in their long-term aim of fundamentally transforming the judicial branch of government to become dramatically more conservative.
And James, very briefly, do you think that this will then energize Republicans or energize men who rally around Kavanaugh, as some Republicans are telling me?
I think that that's wrong. That there's some anecdotal evidence of that, but all the polling shows that this is going to resonate with women, and it'll be a big issue in 2022.
Well, Kim, James, and Jack, I'd like each of you to stick around, and I want all of you to stick around if you can. We're discussing this week's biggest news. You can join the conversation. After the break, we'll take up President Trump at the United Nations. What do you think of his America First doctrine? What do you think of his reaction and reception there? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here. And on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Stuart Butterfield failed in two companies, pivoted, and then built two amazing new companies, Flickr and Slack. Check out How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. And I'm talking about the week in the news with James Homan of The Washington Post, Kimberly Atkins, The Boston Herald, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. The Kavanaugh controversy has grabbed a lot of the headlines, and we'll continue to talk about it for a few minutes and take your calls before we move to President Trump and his comments at the UN. I'd first like to take a call from Hartford, Connecticut. Bill, you wanted to weigh in a little bit here.
Yeah, hi, David. I have a historical analogy here that I think may be appropriate. I think before the Republicans go down this road, they may be careful what they think they wish for. In 1964, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he famously said, "I think I've just lost the South to the Democrats for 50 years." I really believe that the Republicans are about to do the same thing with regard to the women's vote for probably that period of time as well. I think
Gosh.
It's a big mistake, and it's the second Faustian bargain they're making in 2 years, and that's my view on this thing.
And what's your first Faustian bargain?
Well,
what would you say the other one
the election
was?
Of Donald, following Donald Trump.
Okay, I gotcha. Thank you so much for your call, Bill. Let's turn to our resident historian, Jack Beatty. Do you think this could have the repercussions and the implications of a stand that could ultimately erode public support for the Republican Party in the way that he's saying that LBJ had for the Democrats?
It's entirely possible. Consider this statistic. Emily's List, the broker's house for women candidates. They give them advice. They give them money. In 2016, 920 women sought advice on how to run for office. This year, 45,000. That's almost a qualitative difference, not just a numerical difference. Something big is happening. Now, it isn't universal. It isn't all women. But there is the makings of it. And as I quoted Alex Castellanos, the GOP strategist, he said that women are going to come out to vote against Trump because they see him as a culturally regressive force that would undo women's march to equality. There's just no question that that is how they look at him and indeed what he is.
Mm-hmm. The online commenter Chris asks, how did Judge Kavanaugh pass 6 FBI checks in the past? Why did Senator Feinstein's office sit on Dr. Ford's letter for so many weeks? Did she aim to string this out so that the next nominee, had Kavanaugh been rejected, not arrive until after the next Senate sworn in, possibly run by Democrats? A contrary view from Charleston, South Carolina. Lisa, thanks for joining us. What are your thoughts?
Thank you. Well, first of all, I just want to say that I agree that there should be an FBI investigation. I know that Lindsey Graham and others have said, gee, well, he's already been investigated 6 times. Well, it's not about that. It's you don't know what you don't know. So when a new allegation comes up, such as, you know, he did these things in high school, they need to go and speak with all of the high school friends, speak with the people at the country club, you know, find out, did he talk with Christine Blasey Ford on a regular basis? Try to find out those things. Where did parties happen in the 80s? I mean, there's a lot they can do. So
and you and you, you do
pointless. I don't agree with that,
Lisa. When you say this is important and has to be looked at, why briefly? Why do you think that this event from so many years ago is still important for us to understand fully? I'd love to for you to articulate that.
Because it showed me that Brett Kavanaugh may have a sense of entitlement, and that he could have power. You know, at that point in time, it showed me that he disregarded that it was more of a power struggle. And I have a problem with that if that is someone that's going to sit on the Supreme Court. I also worry. Now, listen, I liked him. I liked everything that he stood for. I liked the fact that he was against abortion. But when
so
I
you support
saw
him politically.
In the hearings, you know, the original hearings, I felt like that he appeared to have lied about the Manuel Miranda emails. And that turned me off, and I didn't like that because I felt like, why didn't she own up to that?
Okay, Lisa, so thank you for that. The question of credibility coming up very strongly, even as you supported him politically. He has a big supporter at a United Nations press conference in New York on Wednesday afternoon, just hours after a third allegation surfaced about alleged misconduct by Judge Kavanaugh. President Trump called the entire situation a big fat con job. And Trump was asked if past allegations of sexual assault against him affected his opinion of the allegations against Kavanaugh.
Well, it does impact my opinion. You know why? Because I've had a lot of false charges made against me. I'm a very famous person, unfortunately. I've been a famous person for a long time. But I've had a lot of false charges made against me, really false charges. I know friends that have had false charges. People want fame. They want money. They want whatever. So when I see it, I view it differently than somebody sitting home watching television where they say, oh, Judge Kavanaugh, this or that.
Kimberly Atkins, you know, President Trump said, hey, a couple of people, three, four people have made such accusations against me. It's actually in double digits. How does it affect how you think about the president's support of Brett Kavanaugh that he's faced these accusations as well?
I think that it plays a major role. And I think that is why, look, leading into yesterday's hearing, the president was not thrilled with Brett Kavanaugh. He was not thrilled with how he came across in the Fox News interview. He didn't think that he was fighting hard enough. After yesterday's performance, I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but after Brett Kavanaugh came out so angry, so defiant, and so combative, President Trump immediately tweeted his support for him. He became the kind of combative partisan fighter that President Trump wanted him to be, even though that's usually not what a Supreme Court justice does. And so I think that plays a huge role in how he sees this. He sees these types of accusers as somebody who is as folks who are just threatening him and trying to take away something from him. He's very aggrieved. President Trump is very aggrieved when he talks about people who have made sexual misconduct allegations against him. And we saw that same expression of grievance out of Brett Kavanaugh yesterday. And if I can say something quickly,
sure.
I agree with what James has said and Jack has said about the so-called pink wave, even though I don't like that term because I think it's a lot more than just women who
right.
are rising up and very unhappy with what they're seeing. And I think you are going to see that in turnout in the midterms. You're going to see that in the candidates that are running. You already have. There are a record number of women. This is about patriarchy and people who are in power and who are seen as indignant and any indication that they may be misusing that power in some way, whether they're at an elite prep school or whether they're in the White House. But I do think what we're also going to see in the short term, in the midterms at least, and which is what I think is a motivator for Republicans here, is the anger that Brett Kavanaugh expressed yesterday has been reflected in a core base constituency of the Republican Party and folks who support Donald Trump for a long time. And there was a serious fear that if Republicans walked away from Brett Kavanaugh and did not support him, that they would revolt
and they would hold it against the Republicans. I think now that constituency is energized. They are angry. And I think you will not be surprised if you see an increase in turnout in Republicans now, people who are going to open their wallets and donate money now heading into these midterms. So I don't think it's going to be just the Democrats.
You think it plays out on both sides?
I absolutely do.
Let's take a moment now in the time we have left and pivot to what President Trump had to say when he was at the UN. And before we get to the reaction, James Holman, that he received there, I want to talk a little bit about what he actually had to say. It was an American first message delivered to leaders of the rest of the world. James Holman, talk to me about the thrust of what he said there.
It was a remarkable speech, David, about how global institutions aren't what they're cracked up to be. You know, he goes into the belly of the beast, the United Nations, and he basically gave a speech against multilateralism, against sort of global organizations like the UN as forces for good and problem solving. He, in fact, said that they do the opposite, that they take away power. He said he's going to defend American sovereignty. Sovereignty is a word he used repeatedly.
I think we may have lost James. If you're not there, Radio James, that is all right. We'll try to get you back. But what you were hearing there was an account about the speech, which was very Jack Beatty, very America first, the idea that he's going to all these nations leaders and saying America really is a leader and America is a leader standing in some ways apart. What are the implications of that? What does that mean for America standing in the world?
Well, people say America first is America alone.
My goodness, folks.
Hello? But in all that
in
he
New
has
York,
said—
Can I hear it? Can you folks hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
I am not hearing— Hello, Jack, can you hear me, buddy?
Yes, I can.
All right. So go ahead. Tell me what you make of what the president had to say in that. Well, how does that affect the standing in the world for the nation to essentially say that it's setting out alone, that it's America first and that it's apart from these international organizations?
Well, it could come back to hurt the country when we need allies. But more than anything that happened and more than all the words he spoke were his silence, the silence on Russia. You know, he chaired a Security Council session that was about chemical, stopping the spread of chemical and biological nuclear weapons. He never mentioned the poisoning attack, Russia's attack in Britain. Susan Rice points out that not once in the visit, which was supposedly about our sovereignty, did he mention Putin's interference in our sovereignty in the election. Mm-hmm. And he raised a canard, this idea that it's not Russia, it's China that's interfering in our elections now. And what was that poised on? An advertorial that China ran in the Des Moines Register, the kind of thing you see in newspapers all the time.
All the time.
So this silence on Putin and Russia, the cloud that this casts over this presidency, continued at the United Nations.
Well, James Holman, I mean, isn't this in some ways, though, you know, what he said in the campaign? Why is this weakening America? He says it's presenting strength.
Well, we've seen that he's gone back a little bit on some of his talk about NATO, but you're right. This is what he ran on. He has a lot of people in his administration who do believe in these institutions. But there's no doubt that pulling out of the Iranian nuclear agreement, the Paris Climate Accord, has hurt America's standing in the world. Instead of America first, it has often seemed like America alone.
So then I want to play a clip of what the reaction was from world leaders. It's gotten some play online, but nonetheless, as he began his speech to the General Assembly, it's all these people in that huge hall here in New York. President Trump boasted about the U.S. and about his accomplishments. Here's what he had to say.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Kimberly?
Yes. And very quickly afterwards, the White House came out to say No, it was not the world laughing at President Trump. It was the world laughing with President Trump. We saw President Trump himself make that claim. And also, curiously, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, somebody who generally is not seen as quite the sycophantic supporter of Donald Trump on everything, even backed them up on that. Donald Trump said some time ago, what you see and what you hear isn't really happening. And it seems that that was the approach to try to play down that really embarrassing moment for the U.S. president.
I think best case scenario, it sounded like he could argue people were laughing near him rather than with him. It seems a little tough. I'd like to take a call now from Auburn, Alabama. Bill, go ahead.
Hey, I'd just like to say that, Trump doesn't display the magnanimity of a leader. Mm-hmm. I made the football analogy when a big football player, the quarterback goes into a bar around here. He's got to watch out for people with chips on their shoulders, and he's got to let insults and things run off like water off a duck's back, and he just doesn't have the quality of being a good follower to be a leader. And the stuff that happened in Helsinki, for instance, is very similar. When he's looking out for, like, Fox and Friends' interest in the Golan Heights as far as mm-hmm. that Genie oil drilling is going over there. And it seems like he's given Putin permission to have a referendum in eastern Ukraine. This is just, it's like two mob bosses are that's what our foreign policy has gotten to. And for Trump to talk about other nations and sovereignty and stuff, it's just the height of hypocrisy.
Bill, thank you so much for that. An important perspective. I now like to take a call from Boulder, Colorado. Max, what's on your mind?
Yes, I'd like to just comment that one thing James has proven is that he's an incompetent person to be on this panel.
Well, I can disagree with you on that, but tell me why you take issue with him.
No, that's 100% true. It's absolutely positive true. The only thing that matters in this world is that America is first. That is all that matters. And it's a shame that 90% of your NPR audience is such idiots.
Well, thank you, Max, for your call, but we don't do insults here. We do take opposing points of view. James Holman, I don't need you to tell me your credentials. What I do want you to do is help cast for me in, say, the minute that we have left.
Yeah.
Has America's standing actually changed with the world? Does this speech reflect something different, or is this just rhetoric for the red meat for the masses?
Yeah, I think it's red meat for the masses, David. And I wasn't, to be clear, saying America's not exceptional or anything like that. I'm just saying that I do think America's our allies don't respect us as much as they did 2 years ago, and our enemies don't fear us as much to some extent. There's some complicating factors there related to Iran. The president has obviously tried to engage with North Korea, but there, I think it's objectively true that at a kind of a diplomatic level, America is less well positioned than it was 2 years ago.
Right there, you are hearing the emphatically, energetically, and absolutely perfectly well-credentialed James Holman of The Washington Post to speak about this and many other things. James, I'm so appreciative you took time to join us today.
Thanks, David.
We also heard from Kimberly Atkins, Washington bureau chief, MSNBC for the Boston Herald, MSNBC contributor, a lawyer as well. Thank you so much for joining us, Kim.
Thank you, David.
And our own on-point news analyst, Jack Beattie, as always, we appreciate your insight.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation and get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on the Twitters, find us on the Facebooks, look at us for us on the interwebs. We can be found at On Point Radio. Our show today is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Wass, Alex Schroeder, Kari Thompson, and Miriam Wasser. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.